Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
What we see in nature is a maturation spiral where systems that are in their youthful phase are in competition with each other and oriented around growth and expansion. They come up against each other so much that they eventually learn how to cooperate, take a different strategy that in the long run turns out to be the resilient, regenerative strategy, and that's a cooperative strategy. We are going through that same learning process. Competition and cooperation both play a role in nature. They're both parts of the story, but it is also the case that cooperation is the definitive mark of maturity.
That's Ellen Brown's daughter, Jamie Brown, a biomimicist, discussing how Mother Nature would advise us if it, or she if you prefer, were to design a successful, sustainable economic and financial system. Right off the top, that part about competition suggests that maybe we've got our work cut out for us. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, and today we're going to get back to nature for a bit to see if we can observe and learn some things about how the overlay of monetary control over human affairs is keeping us from realizing healthy economics and even healthy bodies. We frequently discuss the omnipresent pressures exerted on the whole planetary system by dominant financial players, those big money interests that are dedicated to profits and control alone. And we've seen over and over how this domineering force pits people against one another as they grapple over trying to pay off their debt or pursue some transient ego bauble to reinforce their transient sense of identity. It's literally destroying our world and undermining our human relationships. We've gotten to a point in the monetary reform conversation where we no longer expect or even hope for transformation of our financial systems because the powers that be are not interested in alternatives to their fat franchise. We must go it alone into new territory, a new paradigm of collaborative self-interest, if we're to create a vibrant and sustainable new economy. We're going to capture a few more comments from Jamie Brown's discussion later in the program, but Ellen's guest today is one of her old friends, Dr. Lynn Walker, who co-authored several of Ellen's earliest books that dealt with the financial network of big pharma, big medicine, and big banks. When you consider that what we think we know about medical cures and pharmacological remedies is shaped by the profit motive of gargantuan private industries, you can see how misinformed and misguided some of our ingrained presumptions tend to be. So, Ellen, fewer of your readers know that your earliest set of books, the 10 books that you did originally, were on the medical and the pharmaceutical industries, and that you came to banking and money out of studying those fields. Your guest today, Dr. Lynn Walker, has got a whole new contribution to make to that discussion. Where does this lead relative to our money?
Well, yeah, I did 10 books on health and the politics of health, and four of them I wrote with Dr. Walker, who is also, of course, my good friend. But she's a pharmacist. She started out in pharmacy and got quite alienated from the whole subject when she saw what the drugs were doing to, like, little children. And actually, the pharmacist had no control over what was prescribed. It would be the doctors that would prescribe it, and the pharmacist would just have to fill it, knowing that this was probably too heavy of a dose for a child, or knowing what could go wrong, but the doctor hadn't necessarily said it. So then she got into the alternatives. So she also has a doctorate in Oriental medicine and in homeopathy, and I think several other degrees. She has lots of degrees. So she knows both both sides, the drug side and the natural side. And having seen the natural work so much better, I mean, she's been doing that for decades now with clients, and having seen how effective the natural remedies can be, we wrote these four books. The most popular was called Nature's Pharmacy, and it sold 285,000 copies. It sold a lot of copies, but it didn't generate the kind of interest that public banking has because, you know, it wasn't self-published. It was published by a big publisher, and we didn't get the feedback on it. It just was out there on the shelves. So
what is the interplay between this pharmaceutical and medical industry and money? How does our money important in this institution?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually jumped over to writing about money, having seen that how the pharmaceutical industry had control of medicine, even though it seemed to me a far inferior way to cure things, and it's obviously way expensive. And we now have a huge portion of our government budget goes to healthcare, but it looks to me and to Lynn and to people who are really, you know, looking closely, that not only is this huge amount of money wasteful, but it is actually hurting people's health, that the drugs actually are toxic. So what you want to do, rather than putting toxic things into your body, you want to get those toxins out of your body, and you want to put natural things in that work with the body rather than trying to block what the body's doing. So you could save huge amounts of money if you could get this across to the American people, if people understood that. But the thing is, most people are sort of brainwashed and afraid not to do what their doctors say. So that's the point of getting new information out there. Our last book, I think, was written in 2001, and since then there have been new developments in the medical field, particularly in the area of vibrational medicine or energy medicine, and she's really gotten excited about that. So,
well, how do these industries of medicine and pharmacy, you're saying they're not driven so much by results as they are by profiting, by capital investment?
Well, and it seems to me that in healthcare, their goals are opposed. I mean, for the pharmaceutical industry, they want sick people are their market. They don't necessarily want people to get well. In fact, I've heard stories of people who had a brilliant cure and they would, you know, some sort of therapy that was an instant cure for some disease, and they would go to a pharmaceutical company, and the pharmaceutical company would say, well, it's a good idea, but we're not going to do it because we can't make any money off that. If we cure the people, we're not going to make any money. So they actually have a vested interest. Their favorite thing is a long-term drug, like, say, a blood pressure drug or a cholesterol drug that you have to take for years. They've turned health into a market, and so it's got totally different goals than actually getting people well.
So when you were doing your initial research, what was the awareness or what did you observe that moved you into the global banking arena? What did you observe about the medical industry that led you to follow the money, so to speak?
Well, I did some research. I think it was Ed Griffin had a book on linking up. Ed Griffin, you know, wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, which was about the Federal Reserve, but he also wrote about the medical industry and how the big drug companies actually were the big bank. You know, they were, well, it was largely a Rockefeller business, and the chemotherapy drugs were developed from the chemical weapons that were developed by the Germans in World War I. So he traced all that and showed how corrupt the whole system was. And so I realized that if you wanted to fix the system, that the heart of the problem was with the banking industry. That's where they got these big cartels got their power. And that if we wanted to get the power back, we had to get the power to create money back.
So the health and pharmaceutical genius and innovation is driven by a profit-based industry, yet another commodity that the banks and the financial interests control.
Yeah, and they actually suppress genius. I mean, the genius remedies that are cheap, effective, natural, non-toxic, those are the ones that don't make it into the AMA journal. And they're actively fought by the big pharmaceutical companies.
And is the you had mentioned about the health care system that we've got in the U.S. driven also by that commitment to profit on the commodity of health?
Yeah, it is. I think the problem with Obamacare or with the whole public-private arrangement is here you've got a mandate. People are forced to buy health insurance, and they're forced to use conventional medicine, and yet there's no limit on what the doctors can charge. Or I don't think it's the doctors. It's the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals. I mean, for example, my mother was in the hospital for she broke her hip, and the bill was $112,000 for a broken hip. Unbelievable. And she broke her pelvis, which they didn't even do any surgery for, and it was something like $54,000. And she was in overnight, one night, where they just did a bunch of tests and sent her home because they couldn't find anything. It was $12,000. So
wow.
Who pays those huge bills? I mean, I don't think anybody pays them. I think the insurance company rejects a big percentage of them. But still, that's a huge amount of money that's going just to the financialization of medicine. Whereas if you're going to have health care for all, which I think we should have, the whole thing should be a government function. Rather like public banking, we should have a public health system where the whole goal is to get people well, the cheapest and most effective way, rather than allowing half of this public-private partnership to be out there to make a profit on the whole thing.
So when you look at the political movement toward the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and all the other new international agreements, Big Pharma has a stake in being able to price their products around the world to secure their patent rights.
Yeah, exactly. They're making it very expensive for third world countries to get these things they need, like for basic remedies. They have to pay more money than they can afford, and those things should be cheaply available. I mean, at some point we have to realize that we are all one organism, that we're all in this together. I mean, that is the problem right now, is that you have this whole exploitative mentality. We're exploiting the earth, we're exploiting other people because we think it's us versus them. But we can see, we've gotten to be such a global community that we can see that by hurting others or by hurting the earth, we're hurting ourselves. I mean, the earth is our grounding, but that's where we come from, and that's what feeds us. It's the sun that feeds us, and it's the plants that turn the sun into something that we can eat. So It's the same way with other people. We have to find ways to turn this into one big, thriving organism.
Well, I look forward to hearing your conversation with Dr. Walker, and I'm hoping that it won't make me sick.
I'm hoping it'll make you better.
Thanks very much, Ellen, of course.
Okay, thank you. Well, before I wrote Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, and we founded the Public Banking Institute, I wrote 10 books on health and the politics of health, and four of them were collaborations with my co-author and good friend, Dr. Lynn Walker, who it's my great pleasure to be interviewing today. Dr. Walker holds a doctorate in pharmacy from the University of the Pacific, a doctorate in homeopathy from Hahnemann College, and a master's degree in Chinese medicine and acupuncture. And she's worked in the alternative medical field since 1989. The four books we co-authored were The Informed Consumer's Pharmacy, Nature's Pharmacy, Menopause and Estrogen, and Nature's Pharmacy for Children. Nature's Pharmacy was actually a bestseller, which sold 285,000 copies. So it's great to be talking to you, Lynn.
Good to talk to you, Ellen.
So this show is about money, so we want to focus on the financial issues related to our healthcare system.
The healthcare system right now is just all about money, isn't it? You pay and pay more and pay more.
Yeah, and it's not about health. That is the problem. It's focused on money. So we far outspend every other industrialized country on healthcare. In fact, per person, we spend 2.5 times what most developed nations spend, and yet we are sicker and have shorter lifespans than people in those countries. Politicians are liable to say we have the best healthcare in the world, but that's only true in certain areas, particularly emergency care and complicated surgeries. We actually have fewer physicians per person than in most developed countries and fewer hospital beds, and the average American lives 1 year less than people in most developed countries. So how do you explain that we're spending more and getting less out of it, as you say, where the focus is on money and that is a problem?
Well, I mean, I think people are sicker than ever. Certainly people are sicker than, 30 or 40 years ago. And most of that has to do with the food that we eat, the water that we drink, the air that we're breathing, the chemical toxins everywhere, the extra formaldehydes and chemical toxins and chemtrails in our air. So we're breathing bad air or contaminated air. We're drinking water with far more toxins in it, and we're eating food that's genetically modified with insecticides. And I think that that's all contributing to our health picture. And then with the Obama Affordable Care Act, which everyone I think is calling the Unaffordable Care Act, is making it even harder for people to keep up. The people that I know think that the Affordable Care Act was actually designed to fail, and that they're looking to go to a one-payer system. What we're seeing is that our rates are going up and increasing each year, and in January they're supposed to have a substantial increase in the rates that we're already paying too much. So I think that you have to be a lot more responsible for your own health and can't rely on the doctors and the medical system to help you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you could argue that the doctors and the medical system are making people sicker as well, maybe not intentionally, but that's what we wrote about in all those books,
right,
that the system is wrong, that conventional medicine suppresses what the body is trying to do with drugs and radiation and so forth.
I think it's the exact opposite of what you think about your body. Yeah, that we've just really gotten off track from what people were doing before. And I think of the centuries and centuries of people who have lived just fine, and have lived longer lives eating more natural food without the chemical toxins, I definitely agree, and without doing Western medicine kind of things to suppress your immune system.
Yeah, I remember reading a book, it was about people that had lived to be 100, and one man said, and it was what their secret was, one man said, "My secret is I don't go to doctors." He said, "My wife is always going to doctors, and she's always sick."
I absolutely believe that.
Yeah, I know.
They could find more and more things on tests and spend your money running tests, and then they find stuff that maybe isn't even important, but they treat it because they found it.
Right, and you feel compelled to get this test because here you are paying these premiums, and they're covered. The tests are covered, and they tell you, you should get, like my brother got a colonoscopy, I think, at age 50, just because they said everybody should have one at age 50, and it was horrible, and he couldn't tolerate it, and so he didn't finish it, and they said, well, some people just can't tolerate it. But why would you go in at 50 when you feel fine? But people do that. They all go in for these tests that can be quite invasive.
Well, it's all this idea about preventative medicine, that they want to find something and prevent something from getting worse, but the side effects of the tests a lot of times. I mean, remember when we wrote Breezing Through the Change, the book about menopause, you cited that article that said that women that got mammograms on a regular basis had a higher death rate than women who never got a mammogram. And that is still true today. They're finding that it created more problems when you have mammograms.
Right, and one problem is just that they find something that looks suspicious, and then they can't tell for sure. And so then they do a biopsy, which, if it was, like a precancerous thing, it cuts into it, and then it can spread the cancer. So then you can wind up, the treatment itself, in other words, not just the test, but the whole syndrome can make you die of it. And then they say, well, they count it as a cure because they caught this cancer early. Assuming the person doesn't die, they caught the cancer early, and they don't die. And then one reason we have a high cure rate is because we have all these diagnoses that wouldn't otherwise have been called cancers in the first place.
Yeah, no, it was one of the big shocks to me when I was a pharmacist. I had to go to continuing education hours, and I went to a continuing education class specifically about cancer. And they showed in that class that a woman that did nothing had like 12 years, a 12-year lifespan, where a woman who, did the biopsy and found it and did chemo or radiation actually had only 5 to 6 years to live. And I raised my hand and I said, well, wait, is that correct? Did I get that right? And he says, oh, yes, but see, they have much better quality of life. I don't know anyone that's had chemo and radiation that really has had a better quality of life during that time than someone who just really let it go and did natural things to keep their system up. So the whole idea was, and how much did it cost that person? You know, the cost of having cancer today, I think, is a little over $300,000 for the treatment of the very basic treatment of cancer. And then if it metastasizes and goes to other organs, of course, it's much more than that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned about that when you were a pharmacist. So I guess you were a pharmacist for a number of years. What made you switch over to alternative medicine?
Well, first of all, early on, things never seemed right to me. And I was sort of a friendly person, and my friends would come and ask me questions, and they said, you know, the doctor gave me these steroids. What do you think about that? And I thought, wow, I would never take steroids. You know, I think they suppress your system, and then it's not a good thing. Like, you'd have to be in a really acute situation in order to take steroids. And I started thinking that I was selling things that I would never take myself, and that didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then there was a new drug on the market made by Upjohn. It was called Zomax, and it was an arthritic muscle pain relieving drug, and Upjohn was pushing it very, very hard. And I thought, how interesting that they're really selling this drug. It must be really good. And everyone was taking it, and they were having seminars and talks about it and everything. And then just a few weeks after it was released, people started coming into the emergency room with anaphylactic shock. My emergency room, 3 came in one weekend. And on Monday morning, I called Upjohn, and I wanted to talk to them. And I said, you know, anaphylactic shock. And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We have no idea. We did all these studies, and there was no anaphylactic shock. Well, sure enough, just a few months later, Zomax was pulled from the market because people had died. About eight people had died from anaphylactic shock from the drug. And at that moment, I knew that they had lied to me, that they knew darn well that it caused anaphylactic shock, that really I think thousands of people had anaphylactic shock. Only those 8 that I know about passed away. But lots of people had the anaphylactic shock, and they just let it go to make their money back. And I realized that the drugs were all about money, and that as a pharmacist, I was just a drug pusher for the drug companies. And it didn't a lot of the drugs never made any sense to me, and I would never personally use them. So it made me think about things in a different way, and so I started looking into alternatives and seeing what else people could do or what else people were benefiting from.
Yeah. We actually met at another alternative practitioner, or through another alternative practitioner, and when I was a lawyer, but I was a sickly lawyer. That's why I wrote all these books on health. And so when I went into her office, there were all these pictures on the wall of, it was Chinese medicine with all these points and different things. And I mean, it was just like a totally foreign way of looking at the body. And I thought, wow, I never heard about that. I mean, nobody ever told me. It was, you don't learn it in school. It's like we've been sort of shut off from this other way of treating the body, where you're actually, instead of suppressing symptoms with something that costs a lot of money, you're actually supporting the body, trying to stimulate the energy fields, trying to get it to, the assumption is that it's toxins that are causing the disease, and so you want to get the toxins out of there, not put more toxins in the form of more drugs. And you want to get rid of blockages that are, you know, energy blockages. I guess you're working with different forms of energy medicine work right now. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so what I'm doing right now is using a technique from the Netherlands called biophotonic light. And way back in the 1970s, Fritz Albert Popp discovered that plants, and then later that humans, your human body, communicated with each other through light. And it's that our cells hold on to billions and billions of light cells or light particles, and that that's what's actually wrapped around our DNA. There's a lot about this on Gaiam TV if people are interested in learning more about it. GaiamTV.com has some really good shows by David Wilcox explaining about biophoton light and how it works. But what the man, Johann Boswinkel, who's invented a machine called a Schirin, He uses biophotonic light to stimulate your cells to start communicating and alleviating any blockages that you have, so that your meridians, your acupuncture meridians, actually flow better. And biophotons are something that's in food, and in any kind of plant source, and there's a lot of biophotons held in water. So as our water gets purified over and over again, and we use older and older water, and there's more toxins in the water, there's less biophotonic light, so there's less light to communicate with your cells. And there's in our foods, with genetically modified foods and insecticides, they block the biophotonic light, so there's not so much biophotons. The thing in nature that has the most biophotons is, eggs and fresh eggs, and they're finding that the commercial eggs that we buy, because of the way they're washed and the way they're taken care of, they have much less biophotons. I think it's also the food that the chicken eats has a lot of biophotons, and those are the biophotons that go into the eggs. So this is a whole different kind of science. I think it's very cutting edge. They're doing a lot with biophotons at UC Irvine and at Stanford. They both have departments of biophotonic light and learning to do different kinds of tests and things with the body and diagnostic. And there's a very interesting YouTube on, if you Google biophotons and listen to this a TED Talk on YouTube about biophotons. You'll learn a lot about it, and it's really the cutting edge of what's going on.
Wow, that just gave me goosebumps. So when you were talking about the cells communicating with each other, I mean, it seems to me that that's what we're, the cutting edge that we're at now, that it's the same thing in the banking field or the money reform field. I was actually invited to speak at 7 conferences in September and October, and I'm doing 3 of them, and they're all about money reform. Everybody's trying to figure out how to come up with a new system. So the one I'm doing, like, in Berlin next week is there are community currency people and all sorts of different money reformers, and the goal of the conference is to bring us all together, so that we're all communicating with each other and that we're all one movement. And it seems to me that that's what the internet is doing. It's allowing people to, I mean, this is an explosion of information that we've never had before, and the ability to see what's going on in all these other countries when we can no longer be hoodwinked into being told that, the Japanese are slant-eyed devils, like they told people in the 1940s. We know. We can see the people. We can see them on video. We hear their stories and so forth. So it seems to me that that's the stage that we're at.
That we are all connected, and we all kind of want the same thing. We all want our systems to work. But I think the fact that you were invited to all these conferences shows that you're such a fabulous researcher, and I know that you spent such amazing time researching every little detail about it. And you're the really one with the most information. And whenever I see anything written about it, I know that they're always referencing your research. So kudos to you for that.
Well, I seriously doubt it's because I'm a great speaker, but I do seem to be the mouthpiece for public banking, which is, to my mind, is a definite key to the puzzle here, an indispensable piece of the puzzle. But anyway, the vision I can just see of where we're going is that the whole Earth or the planet is becoming like an organism. We're all becoming interconnected, like our nervous system. Once we realize that we're all one, literally, then, or figuratively, whatever, then we can't hurt each other. I mean, because you're hurting yourself. And then we can actually start working together where we're actually doing things like creating the credit that we need in order to do all those things, like, for example, research in medical things health things that will actually improve the body. All the things we could do if the goal were really to help each other and to further, and not to exploit and not to take advantage and
I absolutely feel that that's what medicine's doing right now, is it's a money machine, just making money. And they don't care about getting people well or getting people healthy. They care about making money.
it's why we need to preserve the earth. What you're talking about, the biophotons and that energy, I mean, that energy is also in the grass and in the trees. I've noticed that I'm plugged into my computer all day long, and then I get sort of EMF to death, and my neck hurts, and I, you know, get a little crazy by the end of the day. But if I go for a walk, and I had hip surgery, and I took a class in how to retrain yourself to walk, and the woman said, walk barefoot in the grass or walk in the sand, and that helps your feet, you know, adapt. So I do that. I go for a walk in barefoot in nice weather and, you know, hug a few trees and so forth. I hate to admit that. Yes, I'm a tree hugger. But it's very rejuvenating, and I find that if I don't do that, I don't sleep well, and I sleep much better when I actually tune back into the earth. And you were saying something about how high the EMF level is in Los Angeles, which is where we are. That I think you said it was four times.
Right.
What it is.
Yeah, four times the legal limit, because they keep raising the EMFs so that for the cell phone, so that you get better cell phone reception in the L.A. Basin. That a few years ago, I think a lot of people noticed that they would lose reception, and now they don't. It's because they've raised it higher. But not only do they have the EMFs from your cell phone, but they have smart meters on your house, which puts a perimeter around your house that tells them when you're opening your when you're using your dishwasher, when you're opening your refrigerator, when you're turning on your washing machine. And now they're just starting to have gas meters that put a perimeter in your house and monitor everything that you're doing within your house. So when you consider those smart meters and the cell phones and the Wi-Fi that you have for your television and all those things, it's just way too much for people. One of the main things that I see from it is I see a lot of people that have vertigo or dizziness, and I never saw that 10 or 15 years ago. I think maybe I had one or two cases up to about 10 years ago. I'd only had those one or two cases, and now every other person talks about dizziness and creates other things like depression and things like that as well. So those EMFs are really, really harmful, I believe, to your cells. And there's some really great videos about that that shows how it actually interacts with your blood and the ways your cells in the body work when you come in contact with high levels of EMFs. And then when you add that to other things like the chemtrails in the air, the toxins that you're breathing in, the toxins that are in water, and then the genetically modified food that's full of insecticides, full of chemicals as preservatives and things, your body's just overwhelmed. It's hard to stay centered, it's hard to stay grounded, and it's hard to stay well. It's much easier for your body to just start having symptoms from all of that things, especially when everybody's under so much stress now.
Yeah. Speaking of not being able to sleep, when I travel, I can actually sleep, but the one place I can't sleep is in my own room. And I thought maybe it was EMFs. I got rid of the smart meter, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But you pointed out, I've had like four mattresses, and everyone seems to be worse than the one before. But you pointed out that mattresses themselves are highly toxic, new mattresses.
Yeah, because there's so many chemicals to make them smoke retardant or fire retardant and all the stuff that's in there. And it really takes about 3 to 4 years for it to off-gas enough so that you can sleep on it. So you just buy this new mattress, I guess, and put it in another room for 4 or 5 years so then you can use it.
Or buy it from Goodwill or something.
Buy something used, yeah. Or, you know, they say to leave it outside. Well, that's not very practical either. But you need to at least, at the minimum, leave your windows open. And then not only do you buy a new bed, but usually buy new bedding, and you buy a new, you know, comforter and pillows and all that stuff, and all that is filled with toxins. So you definitely need to wash anything that you buy that's new for your bed and the pads and everything. But most people just take the pad out of the package and put it right on the bed. It's got tons of formaldehyde in there to preserve it. I have a lot of women that work in, you know, like chain, big department stores where they're selling clothing all day that are sick from all the formaldehyde in the preservatives in the clothes to make them look pretty.
Wow.
And so you need to go home and take those clothes and wash them before you ever use them.
And those are all things that we just aren't told about. We've gotten to the point where they'll tell you how much fat is in your food and how much protein and so forth, but they don't tell you that when you buy a new mattress or when you buy new clothes or buy new carpet that you're heavily adding to your toxin level. What other things do you recommend to people, you know, just simple things, everyday things they should be alerted to or that they should do to stay
Oh, well, I mean, you know, about the EMFs, I have them take the cell phone away from their bed or out of their bedroom, and then unplug your Wi-Fi at night so that it's not putting that perimeter around your house. With the smart meter, you should call and have the word is opt out. So you just call the electric company and say that you want to opt out for the smart meter. If you say, I want my smart meter taken off or something, they'll usually argue with you. But if you use that term, I want to opt out, that means that you're knowledgeable about what's going on and that you've studied it or something and that you don't want it. That's a good thing to just very much start and really start looking at what you're eating. You've got to cut out genetically modified food. The problem with all these genetically modified foods is that they incorporate into your cell structure. The other thing that I see a lot of people with lupus, and I believe that lupus is from petroleum-based products. A lot of the stuff that you eat has petroleum bases in it, including like vitamin Bs. A lot of them are made from petroleum-based products. And antibiotics also have a petroleum end, which is something a medical doctor taught me a long time ago. And I'd been a pharmacist for years and had no idea that all of those antibiotics, or a lot of them, I'll say not every single one of them, have a petroleum end that when you take them, they incorporate into your cell structure and they stay there almost forever, at least the life of that cell. But sometimes they're even incorporated into the new cell development. So that you have that petroleum ring, and that's what causes lupus. Lupus is a disease where they're saying that you become allergic to yourself, when in fact you're not allergic to yourself. You're allergic or reactive to the proteins that have bound with the petroleum that are living in your cells. So almost all the women that come to me, I start with the Vaseline. And I say, you know, as a kid, they put Vaseline intensive care lotion on their legs or all over their body for dryness. And they always wear chapstick. And those are the two things that have a lot of petroleum in them. And that's how the petroleum gets in your body. It can get in a lot of different ways. But those are two common things that I find in women that have lupus.
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah. So, no, it's been in the news a lot recently. I think that people who are unaware, those mothers that sanitize everything and that people that use alcohol wipes and, you know, sanitizers and to clean everything, they're finding that actually those people are becoming more and more sick, which is, of course, what I knew for a long time, is that killing all the bacteria in an area is not necessarily a good thing. Everyone thinks that you have to sanitize your whole kitchen and all that, but what they're finding is that those kids are in fact sicker, and when their body is exposed to then bacteria, their body doesn't know what to do with it or how to react to it. That you are better off just, you know, wiping things down with a cloth and not having to scrub everything with sanitizers. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what they found is that all those antibiotics kind of things just make super strains, and so you're actually making yourself, the bacteria, stronger.
Right. So what can people do?
Just not use those hand sanitizers. Just, you know, wash your hands like you would, and don't clear everything with alcohol and those special wipes and all that kind of stuff. That they're not necessary. They're actually creating a bigger problem.
But for antibiotics, I mean, I think they're highly toxic. My mother is 96, and she does have a bladder infection, but every time she takes antibiotics, she winds up in the hospital. I mean, she can't take
them.
And we wrote about that quite, I mean, it's been known for a long time how bad they are, but then what is the alternative?
Oh, there's some great alternatives. I mean, that's what homeopathy is all about for the bladder infection for your mom. There's great homeopathic remedies out there, and there's lots of Chinese herbs, I think, that work really well, and a lot of American herbs, for that matter, that are far less toxic. And what we know is that if you get a bladder infection and that you take antibiotics, then you're almost determined to get another bladder infection from that. If you clear your bladder infection naturally, like with cranberry juice and some homeopathic remedies, then it's much less likely to return, where with antibiotics, it's pretty much a sure thing that you're going to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all really interesting. And then getting back to money and Obamacare, I read that it was, and this is from an article of it called it the ultimate free lunch. That's what Obama said. It would cover 30 million uninsured, and a typical family would see their premiums go down by $2,500 a year. But in fact, according to that article, an additional $7,450 per family. I mean, that's the cost per family of four so far. And then you said it's being raised again in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said maybe that was intentional. So what's the solution there? What kind of insurance would work, or what kind of system would work that would be efficient and not too expensive?
I think I have a perfect guest for you to call and have on your show that will be able to answer all those questions. I don't think that there's any good that can come out of Obamacare, but I'm very much against the way Western medicine is run altogether. So I think that there's people in the insurance industry that have much better ideas than I do, and I hope that you'll have her on your show as a guest.
It sounds like a great idea. We're drawing to the end of our time here. It's been really great talking to you. I mean, there's so much more we could plumb in that area. I've been speaking with Dr. Lynn Walker, a pharmacist, homeopath, and doctor of Chinese medicine.
Noted futurist Hazel Henderson has called biomimicry the logical endpoint of trends in design of sustainable investment. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Basically, it's looking at the proof of sustainability that's all around us in natural systems as the inspiration and exemplar for future design of human systems, even financial ones. We spoke a while back on this program with Ellen Brown's daughter, Jamie Brown, who is now a managing partner of Biomimicry Switzerland and works globally to create economic system design that reflects natural patterns of development, reasoning that if nature has already worked out the proofs of concept, who are we to question?
So I started researching and learning about biomimicry, which is the discipline of translation between natural design and human design. So trying to apply the lessons of 3.8 billion years of research and development to the design of human products and processes and systems. And what I concluded was that this is exactly what the field I'd started in, sustainable development. This is what the field has been missing, because development so far, up until today, the intellectual foundation of our approach to sustainable development has been based in human design only, in human society and human systems. And what this does is it offers us a way to go deeper by looking at ecological design and a much longer, older perspective on the evolution of complex adaptive systems, which is what the financial system is.
But that's a tall order, since financial systems aren't found in natural systems. How can we make that connection?
Nature can teach us things about making smart, efficient, sustainable, long-lasting, regenerative, elegant designs with our big human brains that don't exist in nature. So biomimicry can be applied to products, processes, or systems, irrespective of whether they exist in nature. And in the case of finance, as I mentioned, is a complex adaptive system, and the natural world is the ultimate authority on designing complex adaptive systems that survive over the long term, that are regenerative over the long term within the operating conditions of this planet. So there's a lot that we can learn about complex adaptive systems that can help us achieve the same qualities for our financial system that we admire in natural systems.
But our prevailing financial system is built on entirely different goals than nature's practice of balance and sustainability. And we all suffer as a result, because the disequilibrium that is part of our economics is a tool used by the power centers to amass more control and extract more profits. Consequences be damned.
I would agree with you that the mandate of the financial system is too narrow. Right now it's defined very narrowly and in financial terms to deal with risk management and financial stability. And one thing we can learn from nature is that there is no system that exists separated from other systems. Every single natural system, every living system, is connected to the systems within it, around it, and encompassing it. And the same is true of our financial system. So there's no way to address risk management in the financial system without taking a broader view of a holistic living systems context. And that's what the financial system needs to do.
But as we know, our current financial system is driven by private interests who are not looking holistically at all. It's operating in some version of a dog-eat-dog world in which personal enslavement to some form of debt limits our choices for change, with a challenge to survival for anyone who gets some big idea to try to escape its control. But things are changing, both in terms of awareness and in the appearance of new and robust types of business endeavors and financial relationships that are taking some of these new considerations to heart. In fact, putting them at the center of their progressive tax to solve chronic public and social issues.
One of the most interesting discussions, which comes from the natural world, is the design spiral that's been described by evolution biologist Elizabeth Sartoris, which is a maturation process that living systems go through, where they start competitive. Competition and growth orientation and expansionary focus, those are marks of biological youth, whether you're talking about an organism, like a baby, is focused on growth and expansion of the separated self, or if you're talking about a species, a young species tends to be more cooperative than an older species. We are a very, very young species on an evolutionary timescale. Or if you're talking about ecosystems, ecosystems also are competitive, characterized by competitive relationship dynamics when they are young ecosystems. So that's a mark of youth. And what we see in nature is a maturation spiral where systems that are in their youthful phase are in competition with each other and oriented around growth and expansion. They eventually learn, they come up against themselves, come up against each other so much that they eventually learn how to cooperate, take a different strategy that in the long run turns out to be the resilient, regenerative strategy, and that's a cooperative strategy. So you could say that we are going through that same learning process. Now, competition and cooperation both play a role in nature. They're both parts of the story, but it is also the case that cooperation is the definitive mark of maturity.
So we asked Jamie if we are currently at an immature stage of development, as expressed by capitalism's intrinsic bias toward singular power through the aggregation of assets. Are we logically headed toward a collaborative financial structure that empowers more diversity and therefore fairness, as in the proven strength of biodiversity that sustains and stimulates new types of growth?
Absolutely. That is a very key core principle right now in the discussion of the financial system, I'd say. And the experience of evolution as we best understand it, of course our understanding is always evolving, but based on our best current understanding, evolution agrees with you, that diversity, systemic diversity, is part of the formula for resilience of complex adaptive systems. So even the Bank of England recognized this, or at least it was a researcher from the Bank of England collaborating with a researcher from the University of Oxford who they wrote a paper called Systemic Risk in Banking Ecosystems. And what they did was they drew conclusions looking at ecological design. Specifically, they were studying how viruses spread through networks and the connections within food webs, using those models to draw out principles which suggested that decentralization of risk management strategies would be a good idea in banking regulation. In general, the broader principle that has been identified by groups of biologists that came together to produce a set of design principles called Life's Principles. This was organized by Biomimicry 3.8, and you can Google it. It's in the Creative Commons. Anybody can use these principles. These are design principles that every organism in nature and every natural system at all levels adhere to, for the most part. There may be some very rare exceptions, but these are universal enough that we could think of them as natural design parameters. And in that set of natural design principles, one of them is to embody resilience through decentralization, redundancy, and variation of your design approaches. So in the financial system, that is not what we've got. What we've got is a very, as you said, homogeneous system. We have essentially one species of money that's been planted across the global economy, meaning in terms of what human organisms, what we as human beings actually use in our day-to-day existence to pay our bills, etc., we're using one type of money for the most part around the world, which is central bank-managed, bank-issued debt money, and that's like a monoculture model. So that's like planting one species across a plot of land. That would be the analogy. And it is inherently unstable for the same reason that an agricultural monoculture is unstable, and that a permaculture design for financial architecture has a lot of promise of more to be more resilient for the same reasons that a permaculture model is more resilient agriculturally, more sustainable. And that is a model of systemic diversity, where you would have many different species of money planted across the world, different designs of financial systems grown from the bottom up. That's another natural principle. So you can imagine community currencies that might have, there might be a range of, a diverse range of models of community currencies that are tailored to the context of each local community, that are existing in dynamic non-equilibrium with each other, the same way that ecologies of species exist in dynamic non-equilibrium, and together they achieve resilience that a monoculture can't achieve.
Okay, so maybe you're not into the theoretical intricacies that we've been discussing, but you might give it some thought anyway. Since the changes we must make to create a new path forward for our economic and ecological future must be based on what we know works, and nature works. It's not to be ignored. Let's keep that in mind as we consider new possibilities for an economy that can serve our genuine needs and priorities. Once you know that our current economic system is doomed to fail, perhaps repeatedly before a complete collapse, you can start drawing a natural line around what's required for true sustainability. Our thanks to Jamie Brown, Ellen's daughter, for her insights. She was our featured guest last December on our program that we called Better Listen to Your Mother. You can hear Ellen's complete discussion with Jamie on the podcast of that show, which you can access along with all of our previous programs by going to itsourmoney.podbean.com. You'll need to scroll through for the older posts to get this one. It first aired in early December 2014. Our thanks again to Jamie Brown for these valuable insights. Speaking of economic change, this news out of the UK sounds rather promising. That is, if the new party leader for Britain's Labour Party wins the prime ministership in next May's general election. That would be Jeremy Corbyn, who's a critic of the capitalist system that has shrunk growth and robbed masses of people of their jobs, homes, and more. It's a tale being told the world over. Labour's chances look good. And that groundswell for economic change is being heard here as well, in the very surprising rise of Bernie Sanders' candidacy. But whether it's Greece, Ireland, France, Italy, or Detroit and the rest of the U.S., clearly the natives are restless the world over. So let's take a quick look at some of the changes that the prospective new finance minister of the U.K. envisions. His name is John McDonnell, and he's been named the Labour Party's top spokesman on economic policy by Jeremy Corbyn. And here's what he wants to do. Now, mind you, if this gains traction in the UK, there will be waves of possibility sweeping our own shores as people start taking a stand for their own economic fairness and opportunity. According to Reuters, within the past week, McDonnell, who is a member of Parliament since 1987 and a former trade union official, said that he wants to overhaul their existing system by nationalizing banks and capping executive pay. He wants public ownership of the banking system to take control of what he calls our casino economy. Now, he was talking about the UK, not the US. But it's the same game. Now, this would include full separation of retail and investment banking, like we used to have before the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, and the introduction of a financial transaction tax. A new Labour government would propose reclaiming the power to set interest rates from the Bank of England, which would reverse a reform that was made by former Prime Minister Tony Blair. McDonnell said in August that a Labour government led by Corbyn would be committed to eliminating the budget deficit, but not at the expense of cuts to tax credits for lower earners or to public services or public pay freezes. Instead, he says, the money to balance Britain's books would come from higher taxes on the rich and corporations, as well as from tougher enforcement of tax payment. This would also help to pay for investment in housing and infrastructure. Back in 2012, MacDonald said the income tax rate should be raised to 60% for people who are making the equivalent of $155,000 here, and to 70% for those who would be earning the equivalent of $1.5 million here. MacDonald has called for a cap on wages of no more than 20 times the lowest that are paid in any company. He wants to tackle the gap between pay for men and women. He wants to restore trade union rights. He opposes welfare spending cuts. And on infrastructure, MacDonald says that the rail industry should be renationalized, with workers and passengers given a role in its management. The energy sector he would socialize from below through a huge expansion of renewable energy production and supply following Germany's model. And he's also opposed to nuclear power, which Britain currently plans to expand. Finally, MacDonald proposes that laws on the media be reformed to prevent the monopoly ownership and control of the media by rich individuals and corporations, apparently making reference to Britain's media interests held by Rupert Murdoch. Here in the U.S., of course, 90% of the media is controlled by only six companies. So you see, there's a lot of change out there. And while the Labour Party hasn't won the election yet, the people are getting the picture. Our economic system operates for the few and the privileged, from top to bottom. And there's a clear need to revise the systems that we've enabled to allow for more equally shared prosperity, which was America's great middle-class revolution in the mid-20th century. This, of course, is what the public banking movement is all about as well. Returning the power of our money to the hands of the people, not as a handout, but as a tool for making a new world, dedicated to the health and sustainability of everyone and everything. Much like Mother Nature's sustainable system. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.